Thank a special group of friends of WILL, the members of the WILL Legacy Circle, for providing for the future of WILL Radio through gifts that they've planned in their wills and estate documents. For more information about making such a gift, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-0850. Thank you.
This is Focus 580, and it's hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about music. We're going to play you something that we don't do very often, but we enjoy. Our guy on the board this morning, Jason Croft, always likes it when we play music, so we're going to make him happy this morning. And talk a little bit particularly about a very famous, very well-known jazz music label, Impulse Records. And the relationship particularly between Impulse, between this label, and what was its most famous performer, John Coltrane. Although there were a lot of other jazz pioneers that recorded on Impulse, among them Sonny Rollins, Charles Mingus, Duke Ellington, Keith Jarrett, many, many others. In this hour of the show, we will be talking with Ashley Kahn. He's a journalist who's written a lot about music, particularly about jazz. He's authored a book about the Miles Davis album Kind of Blue and how that record was made. Also concentrating on an album by John Coltrane, that is A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. And he has a new book out that is titled The House That Train Built, The Story of Impulse Records. It's published by W.W. Norton, and it is just out now. And if you would like to call in and talk with our guests, to ask questions, make comments, you certainly can do that. All anybody needs to do to be involved in the conversation is to pick up the telephone and call us. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And any place else you may be listening, around Illinois and Indiana, also people listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And I do want to mention, by the way, that our guest, Ashley Kahn, is going to be making an appearance this evening in Chicago at the Uptown Borders. That's at 4718 North Broadway in Chicago. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. And I'm sure that if you'd like to turn out and meet him, and I'm sure he'd sign a copy of the book for you, and you're welcome to do that. Otherwise, here on the program, you're also welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Kahn, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. Just to start off, maybe the thing to do to talk a little bit about would be at the time that we're talking about when Impulse gets going, what else was happening in the music world at the time? And how did the kind of performers that we're talking about here, Coltrane and others, how was what they were doing different from what from the other music that was going on at the time?
Well, we're talking about 1960-61, so you know, it's pre-Beatles, it's sort of after the demise of the first wave of rock and roll, so most of the music that was around there was either very poppy, like I think the big pop hit for that year was Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, you know, Chubby Checker, etc. And jazz, however, was getting very, very modern, very sophisticated. It was coming out of the 50s. It was incredibly adventurous, with people like Charles Mingus, with people like Ornette Coleman having just arrived. And it was also a golden age in jazz, because from the late 50s through the 60s, you had more musicians around who were alive and vibrant and vital, like from Louis Armstrong to Albert Eiler, from swing music all the way to what they call then the new thing, the beginning of avant-garde. And No label, no record company was trying to record as much of all of these different stripes in the jazz tradition as Impulse was. And the reason it could is because it was part of a major record company. It acted like an independent, like a Blue Note or like a Riverside Records, but it had the money to spend like a major record company.
Mm-hmm. And I think what seems to be important, one of the things that seem to be important here is that, as you say, they recorded a lot of different kinds of jazz and a lot of different kinds of musicians, but it particularly perhaps what's important is that they recorded some that were more on the edge, that were doing more avant-garde kind of music that wasn't quite in the jazz mainstream.
And it was John Coltrane pretty much who led them in that direction, hence the title of the book, The House That Train Built. They were willing to add on to the tradition in a way that other labels had never been able to or had not been willing to. And so the idea that on one day they would be recording Earl Hines in a big band with the Duke Ellington band behind him, and the next day it would be Albert Eiler playing some of the most avant-garde music of the time, speaks very well to what Impulse was about. I think the best example of how they were both forward-looking and also willing to, you know, celebrate and be reverent of the tradition behind them is when they matched Duke Ellington with John Coltrane in this incredible summit that only you know, yielded about 8 or 9 tracks. And that Duke Ellington and John Coltrane album is one of the most timeless classics in the whole jazz tradition, and it's on Impulse.
Let's talk about Creed Taylor. This is the fellow who really started the label with the backing of ABC Paramount. So he had the support of this big label. And as you say, I think you say that maybe Impulse, if that had not been the case, maybe Impulse never would have existed.
Exactly. He was basically a veteran pop producer, okay, who was in-house at ABC during the last half of the 50s. As often as he would produce jazz, he would more often produce either conceptual records or records that played around with this new concept called stereo that would throw sounds from the left channel to the right channel, that type of thing, or pop recordings. But he always snuck in jazz as a priority. I mean, that was his first love. And towards the end of the 50s, he has this huge hit on ABC with Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. I don't know if your listeners might remember that, but great vocalese group, jazz vocal group that did an album called Sing a Song of Basie, where they took all these great Count Basie charts and turned them into a vocal, you know, singing lines. And it was a great success, sold really well, and with that sort of power, he was able to maneuver the idea amongst the higher-ups at ABC, who were, you know, sort of like these hard-nosed, hard-boiled record company guys. They were all about the bottom line. But he was able to convince them that the idea of a dedicated jazz label, high-end, very sophisticated, with nice packaging, with those very distinctive orange and black spines that really stuck out from the record rack when you, you know, put them on the shelf, that this idea could really prove profitable. And that's how Impulse was born.
Yeah, he was a musician himself, Creed Taylor.
Yeah, he started out as a trumpeter at Duke University. In fact, he went to Duke because they were sort of the farm team to the big bands at the time. He was yet another guy who was born under the sign of swing and, you know, decided between pre-med or music, and he went the music route.
Yeah. Well, given the fact, as you say, that I'm sure management is management, you know, wherever you go, they're concerned with making money. Was that a tough for Creed Taylor? Was that a tough sell for him to the guys that he worked for, the idea that this could do well, and you know, I don't know whether they cared about music or not, but he could say to them, not only will this do well, but this is going to make us money.
Exactly. I mean, I think what you just said, David, is exactly right. It's a business. It's like any other business. If you have a project idea and you're going to convince your higher ups to invest, you know, X amount of capital in your idea, well, at a certain point, it needs to show a profit, hopefully immediately. And if you think about it, you know, the very first 4 or 5 albums that came out on Impulse, the very end of 1960 and the beginning of 61, included an incredible Gil Evans album, the Ray Charles's Genius Plus Soul Equals Jazz, and Ray Charles generated a top 10 hit from that. There are not many jazz labels that are born with the advantage of having a top 10 pop hit at the same time. But his instrumental version of One Mint Julep went right to the top of the charts. And the fact that Ray Charles had been signed to ABC Records, which is a big point in the Ray movie, you know, that came out recently, had a lot to do with that. So it was good timing and whatnot. But, yeah, I mean, Creed Taylor went out on a limb. He said, believe in my plan, invest in this. And sure enough, it took off like, you know, a rocket.
Our guest in this hour, Ashley Kahn. His new book is The House That Train Built. It's the history of Impulse Records, and particularly about the relationship between John Coltrane and Impulse. But certainly, Coltrane may have been the biggest, most important artist to record on Impulse, but certainly there were a lot of other great jazz performers who did. And if you're interested in jazz, you're interested in the history of music, you can look at the book and should go down to the bookstore and check it out. The House That Train Built is the title, and it's published by W.W. Norton. And we have someone here who would like to get in on the conversation. We'll do that. Going to Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I must say, David, my pledge money, this program just so far is well worth what I sent back there a couple months ago. This has taken me back in Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, my God. Haven't heard anybody mention them in years. I'm sitting here with 5 of my Coltrane albums, and Love Supreme, My Favorite Things. That's the one I like a lot. I'd like to get a little bit more business-oriented in some sense. I spend a lot of time going through a lot of catalogs from outfits that show you things you never knew existed before, but every once in a while something will sneak through that you wonder what the hell's it here, but you'll buy it, like a DVD by Joan Coltrane, for example. And I start to notice things from Miles Davis, who I have a lot of stuff of, and I was there when he was out, and Sonny Rollins, East Broadway Rundown, for example, is an album I think is really important. But anyway, what kind of restrictions are the companies held to when they bring out work from previous artists? Can they pick and choose from various albums and turn it into a new album? I'm swearing to God I'm getting 2 or 3 repeats from Miles Davis live thing, you know, and I'm just going by my ear, but I often think about that, and since you're the closest person I know that wouldn't have any information on that, that's the question I'd like to ask, and thank God for you, man.
Well, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, David, that's a great, great question. It's basically the reissue business and how record companies now deal with catalogs of material that they own from 30, 40, 50 years ago. It really, it's all about the artist and whether or not they have, artists like Davis, John Coltrane, Duke Ellington, et cetera, are going to have estates, their, you know, surviving family, descendants, et cetera, who have the power of attorney to make certain decisions. And no reissue project with artists of those of their stature is going to go through without the family being consulted. And, yeah, there is kind of a repeat and overlap as certain CDs and collections and anthologies will use the same material time and again. But then there's also, you know, like that East Broadway Rundown album that he mentioned, incredible Sonny Rollins album, that has been reissued just as it came out as an LP on the CD format and is so worth picking up. So in between all of that, you've got to be, you know, a somewhat educated consumer. But, yeah, there is family participation or even artist participation in some cases. Sonny Rollins, for instance, is definitely still with us, and they do consult with him to make sure things are okay by him.
All right, let's talk with somebody else back here in Champaign. It's line 1. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, when I went off to college in early to middle 70s, I fell in with a bunch of music students at Indiana University who were really into jazz and started discovering all this stuff. And at that time, a lot of these labels, the Blue Note and Impulse, were discounting their records. And even though I was didn't have a lot of money being in college, spent what I did collecting a lot of great jazz from the late 50s and early 60s. But it's interesting with Creed Taylor at about that time, he'd started his own label, And his production values seemed to really change. I mean, we used to joke with the CTI records, it sounded as if none of the musicians ever met each other. You know, they just all went in and did their individual tracks in the studio, and then he put them all together. And I just wondered, you know, what you think about the you know, sort of evolution of Creed Taylor.
That's a great question. You know, Creed himself, I've interviewed at this time, at like half a dozen times at this point, is very aware of the fact that he created a certain formulaic way of creating music towards the end of the 60s. I should make it clear to your listeners, David, though, that Creed Taylor kind of disappears from the Impulse story six albums into the catalog. I mean, he starts the label, and within a few months, Verve Records kind of plucks him and says, you know, we're going to use you to helm this label instead. And a gentleman named Bob Thiel takes over. And that's when the sort of the real DNA of the story of Impulse starts taking place. Creed Taylor went on to produce albums like with Stan Getz, you know, the Bossa Nova stuff, and later Wes Montgomery's Going Out of My Head and Day in the Life. And that's when he starts inventing this formula that becomes the CTI sound, very groove-oriented, R&B-flavored, but utilizing, you know, some of the best names in the jazz business at that point, Stanley Turrentine, Freddie Hubbard, Ron Carter, Milt Jackson, and later two of the biggest jazz names of the 70s come out of that CTI stable, George Benson and Grover Washington Jr. The way that I personally feel about it is, it was going to happen one way or another. There was this sort of like cleaning up and processing and smoothing off the rough edges of jazz going on anyway with other labels. Creed just did it a little bit better and got there a little bit sooner than others. The fact that the Grover Washington Jr. sound of the 70s has led to this smooth jazz and contemporary jazz, which to my ears really is much more just instrumental pop, that's kind of sad. But, you know, that's how it is with music. You're always going to have the imitators that kind of like water down what's really great.
Well, the word I would use to describe that stuff is obsequious. you know, I much prefer, you know, the stuff that's closer to the roots. But thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well,
he could be a jazz writer.
I certainly remember the CTI label. I think some people maybe, if they remember nothing else, they remember the striking cover art from those back in the days when, you know, we had album covers and people actually almost collected them for the cover. I certainly remember. And I actually kind of liked those records. Some people said they were insufficiently edgy, but, you know, I kind of liked them.
You know, it's so weird that you mentioned that because that's my next book project. I did all the text for a book on the CTI covers that the photographer Pete Turner did, which is what CTI is remembered for in a big way. The big cannonball on the Hubert Laws album, the ostriches on the Milt Jackson album. So that's going to be coming out in September. It's called The Color of Jazz.
Oh, well, good. I look forward to that. Well, and again, for people who are listening, our guest this morning is Ashley Kahn. He's written a lot about music, particularly about jazz, and his new book is looks at the history of Impulse Records, and the title of the book is The House That Train Built, referring to the important relationship between Impulse and John Coltrane. And we have another caller here we want to talk with in Champaign, line two.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Yes.
Listening to the last comments about Creed Taylor and CTI, I was born and raised in Cincinnati and was lucky enough to go to a club in Cincinnati called The Viking and a club in Dayton, Ohio called Jilly's. And being a jazz fan for many years, had friends of mine. I graduated from high school with Eddie Felsen, who's a bass player, and Freddie Hirsch, who just did an album with Renee Fleming. But one of the things that Creed Taylor did, and maybe people didn't like his music, although I remembered Freddie Hubbard's First Light was one of his albums, and what he did was he brought jazz to the forefront to more people so they were more aware of it and listened to it and bought the records. And, you know, having been around jazz musicians a lot of my life, these gentlemen don't make a lot of money when they play in the clubs. And he brought their music to more people and made the music pay perhaps more mainstream.
I would totally agree with that. I would totally agree with that. I'll tell you this. I mean, now with the advantage of time and looking back, CTI seems a lot less smooth, you know, especially compared to contemporary sounds.
Right.
A lot more hipper, a lot, you know, the groove is a lot more convincing than perhaps, you know, when I was a little more judgmental. And also when I listen to stuff like Albert Eiler and Pharoah Sanders and Archie Shepp, it sounds a lot less edgier. It sounds a lot more almost mainstream.
Now, the business is always, of course, always business is always about money, but my uncle, Joseph Bott, was an A&R man with London Records, and he was on the classical side. And years ago, he discovered an artist called Paul Muriat. I did a thing called Shades of Blue. And then there was another Italian opera singer that he made popular named Caterina Valente. But I think what Creed Taylor did was probably good because he brought the music to everybody's ears.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We have been talking a little bit here about Creed Taylor, who was the guy who started Impulse. And then, as you explain, he was there for a little while and then was hired away and was hired to head Verve. So if you ask really for the people who were on the, the control room side of the board, not the guys who were in the studio, but the guys who were kind of on the other side, if there was one person who was maybe more responsible for anybody else for the sound, for what you heard on the record, that probably would be this other man that you mentioned, Bob Thiel, who produced a lot of these albums. And there, I guess we probably have to talk about what exactly that means, what the job of the producer is, because, while the musicians do their thing and the engineers, they're the ones who are responsible for actually doing the physical recording, but then there is the producer that's really the guy who's responsible for kind of getting it all to come together, and I'm sure can make the big difference between a record that's just pretty good and a record that is really good and the kind of things that we're still listening to now all these years later.
Exactly. I think Bob Thiel was a man of very high standards, much like Creed Taylor. His approach was very different. Talking to Impulse alumni, you know, who are still around, like Pharoah Sanders, Alice Coltrane, Chico Hamilton, whose body of work on Impulse is just incredible. They all say the same thing about Bob Thiel. He was great at getting out of the way. Mm-hmm. And as a producer, he was very hands-off. He was just a presence in the control room. But it was up to him to take the music that was created there in the freedom that he allowed the artists. He would take that, package it, find a way of presenting it to the public in such a way that, one, it would sell and keep the ABC, you know, higher-ups happy, and at the same time, be true to what his vision was of this label. And his vision was that it was jazz from J to Z. You know, so you did have an Earl Hines record, you know, Earl Hines having played with Louis Armstrong way back in the day. And then very next album in the, you know, in the catalog sequence is an Albert Eiler record. And it all comes from his very first few weeks there at the label. Now, remember, he had started in jazz as well, much like Creed Taylor, but he had gone very much down a pop route. During the 50s, Bob Thiel had been recording the Andrews Sisters and Teresa Brewer. And here he was in 1961, coming back to his first love, but needing to catch up because he had no idea how jazz had progressed during the late part of the 50s. And his first project was sitting there at the Village Vanguard in Manhattan, listening to John Coltrane create the music that would become Live at the Village Vanguard. And it turned his head around. I mean, it really took some focus and dedication to realize that this is a new way of doing jazz. And even though he's 39 years old, he wasn't so set in his ways that he could not, you know, see the way forward and allow John Coltrane to take the lead.
Yeah. Well, I have another caller here, and then after that, maybe we should. I know you really want to play some Coltrane, and we do have a CD that has a cut from A Love Supreme, and that was produced by Bob Thiel.
Sure.
So maybe we'll do that in a bit, but let's go ahead and talk with the caller that we have in Champaign County, line one. Here we go. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Coming through all right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about how Thiel and others at Impulse kind of managed these geniuses. I'm thinking of some that I've been lucky enough to see. Some Mingus, Archie Shepp, Rosalind Kirk, who was notoriously. They're all, you know, did he keep them all on for a long time, and did he managed to keep. I actually don't remember. I know some of them changed labels somewhat, but I guess I just wanted to hear you describe how we managed to, stay in good terms with all of these people who are creative geniuses, but also, consequently, I think maybe. Well, I don't actually know the word, eccentric.
Well, I think we certainly got the sense of your question. Not a great phone connection there, so let's go ahead and give our guest, Ashley Kahn, a chance to talk about that.
Bob Thiele definitely had a creative approach to, his primary purpose was to keep albums happening and flowing through the pipeline and coming out there, and good ones. And that meant that if he was going to do what they call a one shot, meaning they would just do a one recording project with a Dizzy Gillespie or Count Basie, then they would do that for Impulse. Then there would be contracted artists who would would just come on for like a two album or a three album deal, like a Sonny Rollins or a Charles Mingus, or not Rahsaan. Rahsaan was actually part of Rory Haynes's band, or you'd have a long career contracted artist like John Coltrane. He was always juggling all of this, and depending on what the contractual obligations were for that artist with other deals, he was able to squeeze music out here, there, or wherever. The fact that Bob Thiele was warmly embraced by John Coltrane and Charles Mingus, not so much by Sonny Rollins, I think it's just typical of the fact that you can't be everyone's hero. And there's certainly examples in my book of where this art and commerce overlap. You've got examples of producers or record men behaving badly, for lack of a better term. But, that is inevitable in any business, I think. But that is sort of the creative way that Thiele approached this. Whatever would work with a certain situation and a certain artist is what he would do to make the album happen.
Well, let's play some music here. And we're going to play a section of John Coltrane's great work, A Love Supreme. This was recorded in 1964. And this man we've just been talking about, Bob Thiele, was the producer on this. And it's a little over 7 minutes. And I want to play the whole thing again because I sort of feel like it's disrespect in the music if you just play it and fade it out. So I'm hoping that people will enjoy just sitting back and listening to this and enjoying it. Now, before we do that, Mr. Kahn, you want to say something about the music?
Well, we're playing the first part of the suite, Acknowledgement.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty much the crest, the most popular album that John Coltrane did for Impulse Records. And it's a great example of Bob Thiele sort of allowing John Coltrane access to the studio, the freedom to create his own sound, because this is so different from where he was just 2 years before. And, most record company men would want to control the flow and progress of their artists. And Bob Thiele was smart enough to just say, no, John Coltrane is on his own search, on his own progress. Let's let him find his way. And this is the perfect example.
All right. Well, let's hear it.
Love supreme.
That is part one, A Love Supreme, part one, Acknowledgement, John Coltrane. That was recorded in 1964 on the Impulse label, produced by Bob Thiel. And this is Focus 580, if you had any doubt. We're talking this morning with Ashley Kahn. He's written a lot about music, particularly about jazz. And he has a new book out that is The House That Train Built. It's about Impulse Records and published by W.W. Norton. If you're interested in checking out the book, you can go out to the bookstore and look for it. Now, this was not the first record that Coltrane had recorded, not the first thing he'd done for Impulse. He'd been recording there for a while. But I'm interested in having you talk some more about how having him be a part of Impulse and his music be a part of Impulse really set the tone for the label. And I'm thinking about the fact that, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, that actually the very first record that Impulse put out actually was Ray Charles. And I think that was in 1960. So there, that would have been a very different disc, I'm sure, than John Coltrane. I guess it, you know, Impulse could have gone in a variety of different sorts of directions.
Absolutely.
Not the, instead of the one that it did. And I know one of the things you're arguing is that having John Coltrane and as being one of your artists had a lot to do with it.
Oh yeah, I mean you can measure it by numbers. I mean if you look at the style of jazz that Impulse was putting out in 1962-63 compared to 66-67, there's a lot more avant-garde flavored, a lot more modern sounding jazz players as a result of John Coltrane's, you know, influence. And none of that would have happened, by the way, unless his records were selling. And that's what really kind of pushed I mean, that always does push a record company in the direction of, of style and music sound. I mean, if they're finding that a certain style of music is selling better, they will go in that direction. And Bob Thiel was finding, he talks about this in various interviews from that era, that strangely, even though John Coltrane's albums were getting a lot of critical derision in the various music papers and newspapers, etc., of the time. And I mean, we're talking even major publications like Life magazine. There was the sales of John Coltrane's albums were really doing well on campuses with younger listeners. And sure enough, by 64, 65, Coltrane's doing interviews where writers are asking him, "What do you think of these young people who are coming to your concerts? You know, I mean, they don't really understand jazz, but still they're attracted to your music." And that becomes one of the other signature aspects, I think, of Impulse Records, is that a lot of people who were buying those records in the mid to late 60s were, you know, shelving them right next to their Beatles and Stones albums and Joni Mitchell and Grateful Dead and Santana. In other words, a whole new generation was coming to jazz as a result of John Coltrane and the other music that was on Impulse.
Yeah, and certainly, I guess that what I remember about listening to music at that time, particularly if you were in a place where there were radio stations that had really free and open formats, is that on any given night, and I remember one particular one in Chicago that I used to listen to when I was in high school, on any given night when they were doing that, you could hear anything.
Yeah.
Well, virtually, you could hear this really wide range of music, and that jazz, stuff like this, like John Coltrane, could be part of the mix. And that's just you know, there may still be some places where they do that, but basically in radio, that's just not on anymore. It hasn't been for a long
time. There was that narrow window of time, you know, when FM radio really became popular in the late 60s, and underground, you know, stations were popping up all over the place, and there was a sort of counterculture element to it, too. And, yeah, Pharoah Sanders, the creator, has a master plan. 30 minutes that shares a lot in the flavor of the times, the sort of universalist spirit and that chanting aspect that we just heard on, you know, A Love Supreme. That sort of carries on with Pharoah Sanders, who was part of John Coltrane's band and went on to have his own very lucrative contract with Impulse. I mean, 30-minute track becomes a top-selling album as a result of this FM radio phenomenon of the late 60s. And yeah, they were playing this music, the DJs were playing this music right next to, you know, good old rock and roll.
Yeah. We have someone else to talk with here in Chicago, Line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I remember hearing John on the late-night radio programs coming from the hotel at 47th and Drexel. I forgot the name of that hotel there. But Larry Smith, the DJ at that time, was playing him his visits extensively whenever he appeared, and I really delighted in it. But more serious question I have to ask you is, I heard an interview with Studs Terkel one time in which a classical traditional composer said that, he had perfect pitch and so forth, that among his students was John Coltrane. And he said, when you talk about freedom and flow, he was able to augment his ability a lot more than he had at that time as a result of working together with this classical composer. And I was wondering if you happen to recall his name, if you haven't heard of it.
I think I do. And I think who you're referring to is a gentleman who ran a music school in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And this gentleman... actually, John Coltrane was able to go there on the GI Bill, and he was interviewed just before he passed as well by John Coltrane's biographer, Lewis Porter, who has a great, great book out there called John Coltrane, His Life and Music, and I believe you would find it in there.
Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And again, other people, if you got questions, comments, you can be a part of the show by calling us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm looking through here the section of the book, and what you do as you go along here is you present little capsule reviews and commentaries on the various records ordered here chronologically, and show the cover art. And one of the things I'm struck by is that most of the covers of the records, at least those that are in here, are not abstract designs. There are some interesting things here and there, like this Sun Ra Magic City disc. But most of the covers were portraits of the performers, and all of them really nice portraits, really beautiful. And I wonder how they thought about what they wanted the album jackets to, what they wanted them to look like.
Right. Well, you know, it wasn't until really in the late 60s and early 70s that musicians began to, you know, participate in their cover art, and what, especially on the jazz side of things, you know, and of course, rock music with the Beatles and the Stones, et cetera, kind of led the way as far as musicians controlling or having some sort of say in the packaging of their music. What you see in that book, and there's over 120 images, is a real attempt to try and replicate the sort of attention to design detail that Impulse Records had, so that the read of the story is as enjoyable and inspiring visually as those original LP covers were. As you were stating, you know, there's 36 album profiles that I sort of shoehorn in amongst the flow of the narrative of the story of Impulse, simply because I really wanted that balance of talking about the business side of things, but also the music, to celebrate the music, because really, Impulse is the idea of telling the Impulse story is somewhat of a gambit. It's to frame the music itself. Ultimately, it's really about all this great music and the musicians who made it. So to get that story across, too, there's a sort of second level to the book, and that's what those 36 album profiles are about.
Mm-hmm. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Ashley Kahn is the guest, and we're talking about his book, The House That Train Built. It's about Impulse Records, and particularly, as the title would suggest, the relationship between John Coltrane and Impulse. It's published by W.W. Norton. The label was started in 1960, and I guess that it really ended. New recordings ended in the late 1970s. So we're talking about that long a period, 15 a little more.
15 years on the edge.
Yeah,
creating edgy music.
What happened? To bring things to a close?
Well, basically, you know, Impulse benefited from the fact that it was always part of a corporate parent, always had a corporate parent, so that when it was time to have, you know, good marketing, good packaging, generous budgets for the recording process, they could always count on ABC. And as ABC's fortunes went up during the 60s and into the 70s with artists like Mamas and the Papas and, you know, on the pop side, Steppenwolf, etc., so did Impulse benefit. But when their fortunes went down, when ABC started to go down in the mid-70s and their only hit maker on the label was Steely Dan, Impulse started to suffer as well. And that's when, the first time in their history, the higher-ups started to step in and say, can't you guys do something more with, like, that CTI label? So the irony is that Creed Taylor's presence, which helped create the label, sort of comes in at the very end as this, less than guiding, you know, influence. People start to leave the label, and then ultimately ABC gets sold lock, stock, and Impulse over to MCA Records, and that pretty much brings the golden era of Impulse to an end around 1977.
Yeah. Although the music still lives, is everything here we're talking about, has all of this been reissued on CD now?
Yes, in varying degrees. Much like that gentleman, you know, the caller at the very top of the show, brought out, there are anthologies, there are collections, and then there are those wonderful CDs that are exactly what got released by Yusef Lateef or Sonny Rollins or Charles Mingus, John Coltrane. Alice Coltrane's body of work, you know, is out there in a big way. My suggestion is always, if you see a CD that, connects with an LP that you remember from that era, don't wait. Snatch it up, because there's no guarantee it'll be in the catalog if it's not selling.
Yeah. Well, that was, I guess it was one of the things that people really wondered about when we got to this point where CDs really started to take off and there were starting to be reissues of music that earlier had been released initially on vinyl. I think there were a lot of people were wondering, well, what's going to get reissued, what's not, and are there things that are likely to be lost because someone's going to think, well, there's no commercial appeal in this, so there's no point in us doing the reissue.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there is this idea that there's this historical importance here, this significant label. And Verve Music, which owns the Impulse catalog now, definitely realizes this. And that's one of the reasons they got behind this book and why there's a 4-CD collection that shares the title and the graphic, you know, image of the book cover called the House That Train Built, the story of Impulse Records that's out there. And they also brought out about 10 best of Sonny Rollins on Impulse, best of John Coltrane, et cetera, that are out there as well. So I think they're doing as good a job as possible, you know,
yeah,
keeping this music out there and alive. Also, I should mention that the label continues to release stuff on the Impulse, you know, with the Impulse imprint, but it's very much a special label that is reserved for, like, Alice Coltrane's first studio album in 26 years. That goes on Impulse. McCoy Tyner does a tribute concert to John Coltrane at the Village Vanguard doing just John Coltrane's music. That comes out on Impulse. So it's very tied into the Coltrane mystique.
We had somebody was interested, just I got an off-air question to have you make maybe some comparisons or draw some comparisons, if there are to be drawn, between Impulse and Blue Note, another important label, one that it was started
another
a lot earlier, but another certainly bigger.
Well, I think that, you know, the comparison comes down to basically two things. Impulse, like I said before, was born in the belly of a corporate parent. and benefited from that, and yet was able to create this creative bubble within so that anything could happen, sort of like an independent record label, but there was money behind it, and there was mainstream access. Blue Note did not have that. Later it did, but, you know, when it became part of, got swallowed up by a major. The other difference is that Impulse was able to embrace a much wider range of styles and really attempted to, from Earl Hines and Duke Ellington and Count Basie all the way up through the bop guys and the more modernist, you know, artists to the very edge of the avant-garde in the 60s. And the effect of that was that not only were younger listeners getting into Pharoah Sanders and Archie Shepp, but then they would go and say, oh, here's a Clark Terry album on Impulse. Let me try this. And so there was this shared modernist sensibility that got spread across everything that was on Impulse. I don't think Blue Note had that, the ability to do that. Maybe they had the vision to do it, but they didn't have the bucks. Mm.
Well, we're going to stop because we've come to the end. Again, we want to read about the history of Impulse Records. The book is The House That Train Built by our guest, Ashley Kahn. It's published by W.W. Norton. He has also authored the book Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece, and A Love Supreme, The Story of John Coltrane's Signature Album. And, of course, this music is out there. If you want to listen to the music that goes with it, you can do that, too.
I'd like to mention the Borders thing, too.
Oh, yes, 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 indeed. And our guest is going to be in Chicago. He'll be at Borders, Uptown Borders, 7 o'clock tonight, 4718 North Broadway in Chicago. So if you're interested in stopping by and meeting him, you can do that. And Mr. Kahn, thanks very much.
David, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it.
All right.
Focus 580, this show made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to talk about one of the great pleasures of life, not music, but food. Some food for thought. The quality of our lives depends in part on our knowledge about cooking and eating. That thought comes from the man who will be our guest this afternoon, Charles Baker Clark. He is the author of Profiles from the Kitchen, What Great Cooks Have Taught Us About Ourselves and Our Food. Again, he joins us at 106 Central Time. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Kansas September wheat trading at 481. That is down